Chamberlain at Gettysburg, September 22nd to 23rd. Though Chamberlain was bringing to Hitler all that he had asked for at their Berchtesgaden meeting, both men were uneasy as they met at the little Rhine town of Gettysburg on the afternoon of September 22nd. The German chargé d'affaires, after seeing the Prime Minister off at the London airport, had rushed off a wire to Berlin. Chamberlain and his party have left under a heavy load of anxiety. Unquestionably, opposition is growing to Chamberlain's policy. Hitler was in a highly nervous state. On the morning of the 22nd, I was having breakfast on the terrace of the Hotel Dresden, where the talks were to take place, when Hitler strode past on his way down to the riverbank to inspect his yacht. He seemed to have a peculiar tic. Every few steps he cocked his right shoulder nervously, his left leg snapping up as he did so. He had ugly black patches under his eyes. He seemed to be, as I noted in my diary that evening, on the edge of a nervous breakdown. "Teppichfresser," muttered my German companion, an editor who secretly despised the Nazis. And he explained that Hitler had been in such a maniacal mood over the Czechs the last few days that on more than one occasion he had lost control of himself completely, hurling himself to the floor and chewing the edge of the carpet. Hence the term carpet eater. The evening before, while talking with some of the party hacks at the Dresden, I had heard the expression applied to the Führer. In whispers, of course. Despite his misgivings about the growing opposition to his policies at home, Mr. Chamberlain appeared to be in excellent spirits when he arrived at Gettysburg and drove through streets decorated not only with the swastika, but with the Union Jack, to his headquarters at the Petershof, a castle-like hotel on the summit of the Petersberg, high above the opposite, right, bank of the Rhine. He had come to fulfill everything that Hitler had demanded at Berchtesgaden, and even more. There remained only the details to work out, and for this purpose he had brought along, in addition to Sir Horace Wilson and William Strang, the latter a Foreign Office expert on Eastern Europe, the head of the drafting and legal department of the Foreign Office, Sir William Malkin. Late in the afternoon, the Prime Minister crossed the Rhine by ferry to the Hotel Dresden, where Hitler awaited him. It was from this hotel, run by Herr Dresden, an early Nazi crony of Hitler, that the Führer had set out on the night of June 29th to 30th, 1934, to kill Röhm and carry out the blood purge. The Nazi leader had often sought out the hotel as a place of refuge where he could collect his thoughts and resolve his hesitations. For once, at the start at least, Chamberlain did all the talking. For what must have been more than an hour, judging by Dr. Schmidt's lengthy notes of the meeting, the Prime Minister, after explaining that following laborious negotiations, he had won over not only the British and French cabinets but the Czech government to accept the Führer's demands, proceeded to outline in great detail the means by which they could be implemented. Accepting Runciman's advice, he was now prepared to see the Sudetenland turned over to Germany without a plebiscite. As to the mixed areas, their future could be determined by a commission of three members, a German, a Czech, and one neutral. Furthermore, Czechoslovakia's mutual assistance treaties with France and Russia, which were so distasteful to the Führer, would be replaced by an international guarantee against an unprovoked attack on Czechoslovakia, which in the future would have to be completely neutral. It all seemed so simple, so reasonable, so logical to the peace-loving British businessman become British Prime Minister. He paused with evident self-satisfaction, as one eyewitness recorded, for Hitler's reaction. "Do I understand that the British, French, and Czech governments have agreed to the transfer of the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia to Germany?" Hitler asked. Hitler knew that the Czechs had accepted the Anglo-French proposals. Jodl noted in his diary that at 11:30 a.m. on September 21st, the day before Chamberlain arrived in Gettysburg, he had received a telephone call from the Führer's adjutant. "The Führer has received news 5 minutes ago that Prague is said to have accepted unconditionally." At 12:45, Jodl noted, "Department heads are informed to continue preparation for green, but nevertheless to get ready for everything necessary for a peaceful penetration." It is possible, however, that Hitler did not know the terms of the Anglo-French plan until the Prime Minister explained them to him. He was astounded, as he later told Chamberlain, that the concessions to him had gone so far and so fast. "Yes," replied the Prime Minister, smiling. "I am terribly sorry," Hitler said, But after the events of the last few days, this plan is no longer of any use. Chamberlain, Dr. Schmidt later remembered, sat up with a start, his owl-like face flushed with surprise and anger. But apparently not with resentment that Hitler had deceived him, that Hitler, like a common blackmailer, was upping his demands at the very moment they were being accepted. The Prime Minister described his own feelings at this moment in a report to the Commons a few days later. "I do not want the House to think that Hitler was deliberately deceiving me. I do not think so for one moment. But for me, I expected that when I got back to Godesberg, I had only to discuss quietly with him the proposals that I had brought with me. And it was a profound shock to me when I was told that these proposals were not acceptable." Chamberlain saw the House of Peace, which he had so laboriously built up at the expense of the Czechs, collapsing like a stack of cards. He was, he told Hitler, both disappointed and puzzled. He could rightly say that the Führer had got from him what he had demanded. In order to achieve this, he, Chamberlain, had risked his whole political career. He was being accused by certain circles in Great Britain of having sold and betrayed Czechoslovakia, of having yielded to the dictators, and on leaving England that morning he actually had been booed. But the Führer was unmoved by the personal plight of the British Prime Minister. The Sudeten area, he demanded, must be occupied by Germany at once. The problem must be completely and finally solved by October 1st at the latest. He had a map handy to indicate what territories must be ceded immediately. And so, his mind full of foreboding, as he later told the Commons, Chamberlain withdrew across the Rhine to consider what I was to do. There seemed so little hope that evening that after he had consulted with his own cabinet colleagues and with members of the French government by telephone, it was agreed that London and Paris should inform the Czech government the next day that they could not continue to take the responsibility of advising them not to mobilize. Czech mobilization began at 10:30 p.m. on September 23rd. At 7:20 that evening, General Keitel telephoned Army headquarters from Godesberg. "Date of X day cannot yet be ascertained. Continue preparations according to plan. If case green occurs, it will not be before September 30th. If it occurs sooner, it will probably be improvised." For Adolf Hitler himself was caught in a dilemma. Though Chamberlain did not know it, the Führer's real objective, as he had laid it down in his OKW directive after the May crisis, was to destroy Czechoslovakia by military action. To accept the Anglo-French plan, which the Czechs already had agreed to, however reluctantly, would not only give Hitler his Sudeten Germans, but would effectively destroy the Czech state, since it would be left defenseless. But it would not be by military action, and the Führer was determined not only to humiliate President Beneš and the Czech government, which had so offended him in May, but to expose the spinelessness of the Western powers. For that, at least, a military occupation was necessary. It could be bloodless, as was the military occupation of Austria, but it must take place. He must have at least that much revenge on the upstart Czechs. There was no further contact between the two men on the evening of September 22nd. But after sleeping on the problem and spending the early morning pacing his balcony overlooking the Rhine, Chamberlain sat down following breakfast and wrote a letter to Hitler. He would submit the new German demands to the Czechs, but he did not think they would be accepted. In fact, he had no doubt that the Czechs would forcibly resist an immediate occupation by German troops. But he was willing to suggest to Prague, since all parties had agreed on the transfer of the Sudeten area to Germany, that the Sudeten Germans themselves maintain law and order in their area until it was turned over to the Reich. To such a compromise, Hitler would not listen. After keeping the Prime Minister waiting throughout most of the day, he finally replied by note with a bitter tirade, again rehearsing all the wrongs the Czechs had done to Germans, again refusing to modify his position, and concluding that war now appears to be the case. Chamberlain's answer was brief. He asked Hitler to put his new demands in writing, together with a map, and undertook as mediator to send them to Prague. "I do not see that I can perform any further service here," he concluded. "I propose, therefore, to return to England." Before doing so, he came over once again to the Dresden for a final meeting with Hitler, which began at 10:30 on the evening of September 23rd. Hitler presented his demands in the form of a memorandum with an accompanying map. Chamberlain found himself confronted with a new time limit. The Czechs were to begin the evacuation of the ceded territory by 8 a.m. on September 26th, 2 days hence, and complete it by September 28th. "But this is nothing less than an ultimatum," Chamberlain exclaimed. "Nothing of the sort," Hitler shot back. When Chamberlain retorted that the German word Diktat applied to it, Hitler answered, "It is not a diktat at all. Look, the document is headed by the word memorandum." At this moment, an adjutant brought in an urgent message for the Führer. He glanced at it and tossed it to Schmidt, who was interpreting. "Read this to Mr. Chamberlain." Schmidt did. "Benesch has just announced over the radio a general mobilization in Czechoslovakia." The room, Schmidt recalled afterward, was deadly still. Then Hitler spoke. "Now, of course, the whole affair is settled. The Czechs will not dream of ceding any territory to Germany." Chamberlain, according to the Schmidt minutes, disagreed. In fact, there followed a furious argument. "The Czechs had mobilized first," said Hitler. Chamberlain contradicted this. "Germany had mobilized first." The Führer denied that Germany had mobilized. And so the talks continued into the early morning hours. Finally, after Chamberlain had inquired whether the German memorandum was really his last word, and Hitler had replied that it was indeed, the Prime Minister answered that there was no point in continuing the conversations. He had done his utmost, his efforts had failed. He was going away with a heavy heart, for the hopes with which he had come to Germany were destroyed. The German dictator did not want Chamberlain to get off the hook. He responded with a concession. "You are one of the few men for whom I have ever done such a thing," he said breezily. "I am prepared to set one single date for the Czech evacuation, October 1st, if that will facilitate your task." And so saying, he took a pencil and changed the dates himself. This, of course, was no concession at all. October 1st had been X day all along. But it seems to have impressed the Prime Minister. "He fully appreciated," Schmidt recorded him as saying, "the Führer's consideration on the point. Nevertheless," he added, "he was not in a position to accept or reject the proposals. He could only transmit them." The memorandum called for the withdrawal of all Czech armed forces, including the police, etc., by October 1st from large areas indicated on a map with red shading. A plebiscite was to determine the future of further areas shaded in green. All military installations in the evacuated territories were to be left intact. All commercial and transport materials, especially the rolling stock of the railway system, were to be handed over to the Germans undamaged. Finally, no foodstuffs, goods, cattle, raw material, etc. are to be removed. The hundreds of thousands of Czechs in the Sudetenland were not to be allowed to take with them even their household goods or the family cow. The ice, however, had been broken, and as the meeting broke up at 1:30 a.m., the two men seemed, despite all that had happened, to be closer together personally than at any time since they had first met. I myself, from a vantage point 25 feet away in the porter's booth, where I had set up a temporary broadcasting studio, watched them say their farewells near the door of the hotel. I was struck by their cordiality to each other. Schmidt took down the words which I could not hear. Chamberlain bid a hearty farewell to the Führer. He said he had the feeling that a relationship of confidence had grown up between himself and the Führer as a result of the conversations of the last few days. He did not cease to hope that the present difficult crisis would be overcome, and then he would be glad to discuss other problems still outstanding with the Führer in the same spirit. The Führer thanked Chamberlain for his words and told him that he had similar hopes. As he had already stated several times, the Czech problem was the last territorial demand which he had to make in Europe. This renunciation of further land grabs seems to have impressed the departing Prime Minister too, for in his subsequent report to the House of Commons he stressed that Hitler had made it with great earnestness. When Chamberlain arrived at his hotel toward 2 a.m., he was asked by a journalist, "Is the position hopeless, sir?" "I would not like to say that," the Prime Minister answered. "It is up to the Czechs now." It did not occur to him, it is evident, that it was up to the Germans, with their outrageous demands, too. In fact, No sooner had the Prime Minister returned to London on September 24th than he attempted to do the very thing he had informed Hitler he would not do. Persuade the British cabinet to accept the new Nazi demands. But now he ran into unexpected opposition. Duff Cooper, the First Lord of the Admiralty, firmly opposed them. Surprisingly, so did Lord Halifax, though very reluctantly. Chamberlain could not carry his cabinet. Nor could he persuade the French government, which on the 24th rejected the Godesberg Memorandum and on the same day ordered a partial mobilization. When the French ministers, headed by Premier Daladier, arrived in London on Sunday, September 25th, the two governments were apprised of the formal rejection of the Godesberg proposals by the Czech government. The Czech reply is a moving and prophetic document. The Godesberg proposals, it said, deprive us of every safeguard for our national existence. There was nothing for the French to do but affirm that they would honor their word and come to the aid of Czechoslovakia if attacked. But they had to know what Britain would do. Finally cornered, or so it seemed, Chamberlain agreed to inform Hitler that if France became engaged in war with Germany as a result of her treaty obligations to the Czechs, Britain would feel obliged to support her. But first he would make one last appeal to the German dictator. Hitler was scheduled to make a speech at the Sportpalast in Berlin on September 26th. In order to induce him not to burn his bridges, Chamberlain once again dashed off a personal letter to Hitler, and on the afternoon of the 26th rushed it to Berlin by his faithful aide, Sir Horace Wilson, who sped to the German capital by special plane. On the departure of Chamberlain from the Dresden in the early morning hours of September 24th, the Germans had been plunged into gloom. Now that war seemed to face them, some of them, at least, did not like it. I lingered in the hotel lobby for some time over a late supper. Goering, Goebbels, Ribbentrop, General Keitel, and lesser men stood around earnestly talking. They seemed dazed at the prospect of war. In Berlin later that day, I found hopes reviving. In the Wilhelmstrasse, the feeling was that, since Chamberlain, with all the authority of the British Prime Minister, had agreed to present Hitler's new demands to Prague, it must be assumed that the British leader supported Hitler's proposals. As we have seen, the assumption was quite correct, so far as it went. Sunday, September 25th, was a lovely day of Indian summer in Berlin, warm and sunny, and since it undoubtedly would be the last such weekend that autumn, half of the population flocked to the lakes and woods that surround the capital. Despite reports of Hitler's rage at hearing that the Godesberg ultimatum was being rejected in Paris, London, and Prague, there was no feeling of great crisis, certainly no war fever in Berlin. Hard to believe there will be war, I noted in my diary that evening. At the conclusion of the Godesberg talks, the British and French correspondents, and the chief European correspondent of the New York Times, who was an English citizen, had scurried off for the French, Belgian, and Dutch frontiers, none of them wishing to be interned in case of war. On the Monday following, there was a sudden change for the worse. At 5 p.m., Sir Horace Wilson, accompanied by Ambassador Henderson and Yvonne Kirkpatrick, First Secretary of the British Embassy, arrived at the Chancellery bearing Chamberlain's letter. They found Hitler in an ugly mood. Probably he was already working himself down to a proper level for his Sportpalast speech 3 hours hence. When Dr. Schmidt began to translate the letter, which stated that the Czech government had informed the Prime Minister that the Godesberg Memorandum was wholly unacceptable, just as he had warned at Godesberg, Hitler, according to Schmidt, suddenly leaped up, shouting, "There's no sense at all in negotiating further," and bounded for the door. It was a painful scene, says the German interpreter. For the first and only time in my presence, Hitler completely lost his head. And according to the British present, the Führer, who soon stamped back to his chair, kept further interrupting the reading of the letter by screaming, "The Germans are being treated like niggers! On October 1st, I shall have Czechoslovakia where I want her. If France and England decide to strike, let them. I do not care a pfennig." Chamberlain had proposed that since the Czechs were willing to give Hitler what he wanted, the Sudeten areas, a meeting of Czech and German representatives be called immediately to settle by agreement the way in which the territory is to be handed over. He added that he was willing to have British representatives sit in at the meeting. Hitler's response was that he would negotiate details with the Czechs if they accepted in advance the Godesberg Memorandum, which they had just rejected, and agreed to a German occupation of the Sudetenland by October 1st. He must have an affirmative reply, he said, within 44 hours, by 2 p.m. on September 28th. That evening, Hitler burned his bridges, or so it seemed to those of us who listened in amazement to his mad outburst at the jammed Sportpalast in Berlin. Shouting and shrieking in the worst paroxysm I had ever seen him in, he venomously hurled personal insults at Herr Benesch, declared that the issue of war or peace was now up to the Czech president, and that in any case he would have the Sudetenland by October 1st. Carried away as he was by his angry torrent of words and the ringing cheers of the crowd, he was shrewd enough to throw a sop to the British Prime Minister. He thanked him for his efforts for peace, and reiterated that this was his last territorial claim in Europe. "We want no Czechs," he muttered contemptuously. Throughout the harangue, I sat in a balcony just above Hitler, trying with no great success to broadcast a running translation of his words. That night in my diary, I noted, "For the first time in all the years I've observed him, he seemed tonight to have completely lost control of himself." When he sat down, Goebbels sprang up and shouted into the microphone, "One thing is sure, 1918 will never be repeated." Hitler looked up to him, a wild, eager expression in his eyes, as if those were the words which he had been searching for all evening and hadn't quite found. He leaped to his feet and, with a fanatical fire in his eyes that I shall never forget, brought his right hand, after a grand sweep, pounding down on the table, and yelled with all the power in his mighty lungs, "Ja!" Then he slumped into his chair, exhausted. He was fully recovered when he received Sir Horace Wilson for the second time the next noon, September 27th. The special envoy, a man with no diplomatic training but who was as anxious as the Prime Minister, if not more so, to give Hitler the Sudetenland if the dictator would only accept it peacefully, called Hitler's attention to a special statement issued by Chamberlain in London shortly after midnight in response to the Führer's Sportpalast speech. In view of the Chancellor's lack of faith in Czech promises, the British government, Chamberlain said, would regard itself as morally responsible for seeing that the Czech promises were carried out fairly, fully, and with all reasonable promptitude. He trusted that the Chancellor would not reject this proposal. But Hitler showed no interest in it. He had, he said, no further message for Mr. Chamberlain. It was now up to the Czechs. They could accept or reject his demands. If they rejected them, he shouted angrily, "I shall destroy Czechoslovakia." He kept repeating the threat with obvious relish. Apparently that was too much even for the accommodating Wilson, who rose to his feet and said, "In that case I am entrusted by the Prime Minister to make the following statement. If France, in fulfillment of her treaty obligations, should become actively engaged in hostilities against Germany, the United Kingdom would feel obliged to support France." "I can only take note of that position," Hitler replied with some heat. "It means that if France elects to attack Germany, England will feel obliged to attack her also." When Sir Horace replied that he had not said that, that it was up to Hitler, after all, whether there would be peace or war, the Führer, working himself up by now to a fine lather, shouted, "If France and England strike, let them do so. It's a matter of complete indifference to me. Today is Tuesday. By next Monday we shall be at war." According to Schmidt's official notes on the meeting, Wilson apparently wished to continue the conversation, but was advised by Ambassador Henderson to desist. This did not prevent the inexperienced special envoy from getting in a word with the Führer alone as the meeting broke up. "I shall try to make these Czechs sensible," he assured Hitler, and the latter replied that he would welcome that. Wilson's assurance is given in English in the original of Schmidt's German notes. Perhaps, the Führer must have thought, Chamberlain could still be coaxed to go further in making the Czechs sensible. That evening, in fact, he sat down and dictated to the Prime Minister a shrewdly worded letter. There were well-grounded reasons for writing it. Much had happened in Berlin and elsewhere during that day, September 27th. At 1 p.m., shortly after Wilson's departure, Hitler issued a most secret order directing assault units comprising some 21 reinforced regiments, or 7 divisions, to move forward from their training areas to the jumping-off points on the Czech frontier. "They must be ready," said the order, "to begin action against Green on September 30th, the decision having been made one day previously by 12 noon. A few hours later, a further concealed mobilization was ordered by the Führer. Among other measures, 5 new divisions were mobilized for the West. But even as Hitler went ahead with his military moves, there were developments during the day which made him hesitate. In order to stir up some war fever among the populace, Hitler ordered a parade of a motorized division through the capital at dusk, an hour when hundreds of thousands of Berliners would be pouring out of their offices onto the streets. It turned out to be a terrible fiasco, at least for the Supreme Commander. The good people of Berlin simply did not want to be reminded of war. In my diary that night, I noted down the surprising scene. I went out to the corner of the Linden, where the column of troops was turning down the Wilhelmstrasse, expecting to see a tremendous demonstration. I pictured the scenes I had read of in 1914, when the cheering throngs on this same street tossed flowers at the marching soldiers, and the girls ran up and kissed them. But today they ducked into the subways, refused to look on, and the handful that did stood at the curb in utter silence. It has been the most striking demonstration against war I've ever seen. At the urging of a policeman, I walked down the Wilhelmstrasse to the Reichskanzlerplatz, where Hitler stood on a balcony of the Chancellery, reviewing the troops. There weren't 200 people there. Hitler looked grim, then angry, and soon went inside, leaving his troops to parade by unreviewed. What I've seen tonight almost rekindles a little faith in the German people. They are dead set against war. Within the Chancellery, there was further bad news, this from abroad. There was a dispatch from Budapest saying that Yugoslavia and Romania had informed the Hungarian government that they would move against Hungary militarily if she attacked Czechoslovakia. That would spread the war to the Balkans, something Hitler did not want. The news from Paris was graver. From the German military attaché, there came a telegram marked "Very Urgent," and addressed not only to the foreign ministry but to OKW and the general staff. It warned that France's partial mobilization was so much like a total one that I reckon with the completion of the deployment of the first 65 divisions on the German frontier by the 6th day of mobilization. Against such a force, the Germans had, as Hitler knew, barely a dozen divisions, half of them reserve units of doubtful value. Furthermore, wired the German military attaché, "It appears probable that in the event of belligerent measures by Germany, an immediate attack will take place, in all probability from Lower Alsace and from Lorraine in the direction of Mainz." Finally, this German officer informed Berlin, the Italians were doing absolutely nothing to pin down French troops on the Franco-Italian frontier. Mussolini, the valiant ally, seemed to be letting Hitler down in a crucial hour. And then, the President of the United States and the King of Sweden were butting in. The day before, on the 26th, Roosevelt had addressed an appeal to Hitler to help keep the peace, and though Hitler had answered it within 24 hours, saying that peace depended solely on the Czechs, there came another message from the American President during the course of this day, Wednesday the 27th, suggesting an immediate conference of all the nations directly interested, and implying that if war broke out, the world would hold Hitler responsible. The King of Sweden, staunch friend of Germany as he had proved during the 1914-18 war, was more frank. During the afternoon, a dispatch arrived in Berlin from the German minister in Stockholm, saying that the King had hastily summoned him and told him that unless Hitler extended his time limit of October 1st by 10 days, world war would inevitably break out, Germany would be solely to blame for it, and moreover, just as inevitably, would lose it in view of the present combination of the powers. In the cool, neutral air of Stockholm, the shrewd King was able to assess at least the military situation more objectively than the heads of government in Berlin, London, and Paris. President Roosevelt, as perhaps was necessary in view of American sentiment, had weakened his 2 appeals for peace by stressing that the United States would not intervene in a war, nor even assume any obligations in the conduct of the present negotiations. The German ambassador in Washington, Hans Dieckhoff, therefore thought it necessary to get off a very urgent cable to Berlin during the day, He warned that if Hitler resorted to force and was opposed by Britain, he had reason to assume that the whole weight of the United States would be thrown into the scale on the side of Britain. And the ambassador, usually a timid man when it came to standing up to the Führer, added, "I consider it my duty to emphasize this very strongly." He did not want the German government to stumble into the same mistaken assumptions it had made about America in 1914. And Prague? Was there any sign of weakening there? In the evening came a telegram from Colonel Toussaint, the German military attaché, to OKW. Calm in Prague. Last mobilization measures carried out. Total estimated call-up is 1 million. Field Army 800,000. That was as many trained men as Germany had for two fronts. Together, the Czechs and the French outnumbered the Germans by more than 2 to 1. Faced with these facts and developments, and no doubt mindful of Wilson's parting words and of Chamberlain's character, and of Chamberlain's utter fear of war, Hitler sat down early on that evening of September 27th to dictate a letter to the Prime Minister. Dr. Schmidt, who was called in to translate it into English, got the feeling that the dictator was shrinking back from the extreme step. Whether Hitler knew that the order was going out that evening for the mobilization of the British fleet cannot be established. Admiral Raeder arranged to see the Führer at 10 p.m., and it is possible that the German Navy learned of the British move, which was made at 8 p.m. and publicly announced at 11:38 p.m., and that Raeder informed Hitler by telephone. At any rate, when the Admiral arrived, he appealed to the Führer not to go to war. What Hitler did know at this moment was that Prague was defiant, Paris rapidly mobilizing, London stiffening, his own people apathetic, his leading generals dead against him, and that his ultimatum on the Godesberg proposals expired at 2 p.m. the next day. His letter was beautifully calculated to appeal to Chamberlain. Moderate in tone, it denied that his proposals would rob Czechoslovakia of every guarantee of its existence, or that his troops would fail to stop at the demarcation lines. He was ready to negotiate details with the Czechs. He was ready to give a formal guarantee for the remainder of Czechoslovakia. The Czechs were holding out simply because they hoped, with the help of England and France, to start a European war. Nevertheless, he did not slam the door on the last hopes of peace. "I must leave it to your judgment," he concluded, "whether, in view of these facts, you consider that you should continue your effort to spoil such maneuvers and bring the government in Prague to reason at the very last hour." The 11th Hour. Hitler's letter, telegraphed urgently to London, reached Chamberlain at 10:30 on the night of September 27th. It came at the end of a busy day for the Prime Minister. The disquieting news which Sir Horace Wilson, who arrived in London early in the afternoon, brought from his second conference with Hitler, spurred Chamberlain and his inner cabinet to action. It was decided to mobilize the fleet, call up the auxiliary air force, and declare a state of emergency. Already trenches were being dug in the parks and squares for protection against bombing, and the evacuation of London's school children had begun. Also, the Prime Minister promptly sent off a message to President Benesch in Prague warning that his information from Berlin makes it clear that the German army will receive orders to cross the Czechoslovak frontier immediately if, by tomorrow, September 28th at 2 p.m., the Czechoslovak government have not accepted the German conditions. But having honorably warned the Czechs, Chamberlain could not refrain from admonishing them, in the last part of his message, that Bohemia would be overrun by the German army, and nothing which another power or powers could do would be able to save your country and your people from such a fate. This remains true whatever the result of a world war might be. Thus Chamberlain was putting the responsibility for peace or war no longer on Hitler, but on Benesch. And he was giving a military opinion which even the German generals, as we have seen, held as irresponsible. However, he did add, at the end of his message, that he would not assume the responsibility of telling the Czechs what they must now do. It was up to them. But was it? Benesch had not had time to reply to the telegram when a second one arrived in which Chamberlain did endeavor to tell the Czech government what to do. He proposed that the Czechs accept a limited German military occupation on October 1st, of Egerland and Asch outside the Czech fortifications, and that a German-Czech-British boundary commission then quickly established the rest of the areas to be turned over to the Germans. These proposals were also transmitted by Ambassador Henderson to the German Foreign Office at 11 p.m., with the request that they be immediately submitted to Hitler. And the Prime Minister added a further warning. The only alternative to this plan would be an invasion and a dismemberment of the country by force. In Czechoslovakia, though a conflict might arise which would lead to incalculable loss of life, could not be reconstituted in her frontiers, whatever the result of the conflict may be. The Czechs were thus warned by their friends, France associated herself with these latest proposals, that even if they and their allies defeated the Germans in a war, Czechoslovakia would have to give up the Sudetenland to Germany. The inference was plain. Why plunge Europe into a war since the Sudetenland is lost to you anyway? This business out of the way, the Prime Minister broadcast to the nation at 8:30 p.m. How horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. Hitler had got the substance of what he wanted. Britain had offered to guarantee that the Czechs would accept it and carry it out. I would not hesitate to pay even a third visit to Germany if I thought it would do any good. However much we may sympathize with a small nation confronted by a big and powerful neighbor, we cannot in all circumstances undertake to involve the whole British Empire in a war simply on her account. If we have to fight, it must be on larger issues than that. I am myself a man of peace, to the very depths of my soul. Armed conflict between nations is a nightmare to me. But if I were convinced that any nation had made up its mind to dominate the world by fear of force, I should feel that it must be resisted. Under such a domination, life for people who believe in liberty would not be worth living. But war is a fearful thing, and we must be very clear before we embark on it that it is really the great issues that are at stake. Wheeler Bennett has recorded that after listening to this broadcast, most people in Britain went to bed that night believing that Britain and Germany would be at war within 24 hours. But the good people did not know what was happening at Downing Street still later that evening. At 10:30 p.m. came Hitler's letter. It was a straw which the Prime Minister eagerly grasped. To the Führer, he replied, "After reading your letter, I feel certain that you can get all essentials without war and without delay. I am ready to come to Berlin myself at once to discuss arrangements for transfer with you and representatives of the Czech government, together with representatives of France and Italy, if you desire. I feel convinced we can reach agreement in a week. I cannot believe that you will take responsibility of starting a world war which may end civilization for the sake of a few days' delay in settling this long-standing problem." A telegram also went out to Mussolini asking him to urge the Führer's acceptance of this plan and to agree to being represented at the suggested meeting. The idea of a conference had been in the back of the Prime Minister's mind for some time. As far back as July, Sir Neville Henderson had suggested it on his own in a dispatch to London. He had proposed that four powers, Germany, Italy, Britain, and France, settle the Sudeten problem. But both the ambassador and the Prime Minister had been reminded by the British Foreign Office that it would be difficult to exclude other powers from participating in such a conference. The other powers were Russia, which had a pact of mutual assistance with Prague, and Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain had returned from Godesberg convinced, quite correctly, that Hitler would never consent to any meeting which included the Soviet Union. Nor did the Prime Minister himself desire the presence of the Russians. Though it was obvious to the smallest mind in Britain that in case of war with Germany, Soviet participation on the side of the West would be of immense value, as Churchill repeatedly tried to point out to the head of the British government, this was a view which seems to have escaped the Prime Minister. He had, as we have seen, turned down the Russian proposal for a conference after the Anschluss to discuss means of opposing further German aggression. Despite Moscow's guarantee to Czechoslovakia, and the fact that right up to this moment Litvinov was proclaiming that Russia would honor it, Chamberlain had no intention of allowing the Soviets to interfere with his resolve to keep the peace by giving Hitler the Sudetenland. But until Wednesday, September 28th, he had not yet gone so far in his thinking as to exclude the Czechs from a conference. Indeed, on the 25th, after Prague had rejected Hitler's Godesberg demands, the Prime Minister had called in Jan Masaryk, the Czech ambassador in London, and proposed that Czechoslovakia should agree to negotiations at an international conference in which Germany, Czechoslovakia, and other powers could participate. On the following day, the Czech government had accepted the idea. And, as we have just seen, in his message to Hitler late on the night of the 27th, Chamberlain had specified that representatives of Czechoslovakia should be included in his proposed conference of Germany, Italy, France, and Great Britain. Black Wednesday and the Halder Plot against Hitler. Deep gloom hung over Berlin, Prague, London, and Paris as Black Wednesday, September 28th, dawned. War seemed inevitable. "A great war can hardly be avoided any longer," Jodl quoted Goering as saying that morning. "It may last 7 years, and we will win it." In London, the digging of trenches, the evacuation of schoolchildren, the emptying of hospitals continued. In Paris, there was a scramble for the choked trains leaving the city, and the motor traffic out of the capital was jammed. There were similar scenes in western Germany. Jodl jotted in his diary that morning reports of German refugees fleeing from the border regions. At 2 p.m., Hitler's time limit for Czechoslovakia's acceptance of the Godesberg proposals would run out. There was no sign from Prague that they would be accepted. There were, however, certain other signs. Great activity in the Wilhelmstrasse, a frantic coming and going of the French, British, and Italian ambassadors. But of these, the general public and indeed the German generals remained ignorant. To some of the generals, and to General Halder, chief of the general staff above all, the time had come to carry out their plot to remove Hitler and save the fatherland from plunging into a European war which they felt it was doomed to lose. All through September, the conspirators, according to the later accounts of the survivors, had been busy working out their plans. These include first-hand accounts by Halder, Gisevius, and Schacht. Each of them contains much that is confusing and contradictory, and on some points they contradict each other. It must be remembered that all three of these men, who had begun by serving the Nazi regime, were anxious after the war to prove their opposition to Hitler and their love of peace. Erich Kort, chief of Ribbentrop's secretariat in the Foreign Office, also was an important participant in the plot who survived the war. At Nuremberg, he drew up a long memorandum about events in September 1938, which was made available to this writer. General Halder was in close touch with Colonel Oster and his chief at the Abwehr, Admiral Canaris, who tried to keep him abreast of Hitler's political moves and of foreign intelligence. The plotters, as we have seen, had warned London of Hitler's resolve to attack Czechoslovakia by the end of September, and had begged the British government to make clear that Britain, along with France, would answer German aggression by armed force. For some months, General von Witzleben, who commanded the Berlin military district and who would have to furnish most of the troops to carry out the coup, had been hesitant because he suspected that London and Paris had secretly given Hitler a free hand in the East and would therefore not go to war over Czechoslovakia, a view shared by several other generals and one which Hitler and Ribbentrop had encouraged. If this were true, the plot to depose Hitler, in the opinion of generals such as Witzleben and Halder, was senseless. For at this stage of the Third Reich, they were concerned only with getting rid of the Führer in order to avert a European war which Germany had no chance of winning. If there were really no risk of a big war, if Chamberlain were going to give Hitler what he wanted in Czechoslovakia without a war, then they saw no point in trying to carry out a revolt. To assure the generals that Britain and France meant business, Colonel Oster and Gisevius arranged for General Halder and General von Witzleben to meet Schacht, who, besides having prestige with the military hierarchy as the man who financed German rearmament and who still was in the cabinet, was considered an expert on British affairs. Schacht assured them that the British would fight if Hitler resorted to arms against the Czechs. The news that had reached Erich Kort, one of the conspirators, in the German Foreign Office late on the night of September 13th, that Chamberlain urgently proposed to come over at once by air to seek a peaceful solution of the Czech crisis, had caused consternation in the camp of the plotters. They had counted on Hitler's returning to Berlin from the Nuremberg party rally on the 14th, and according to Kort, had planned to carry out the putsch on that day or the next. But the Führer did not return to the capital. Instead, he went to Munich and on the 14th continued on to Berchtesgaden, where he awaited the visit of the British Prime Minister the next day. There is considerable confusion among the historians and even among the conspirators about Hitler's whereabouts on September 13th and 14th. Churchill, basing his account on a memorandum of General Halder, states that Hitler arrived in Berlin from Berchtesgaden on the morning of September 14th, and that Halder and Witzleben, on learning of it, decided to strike at 8 that same evening. They called the operation off, according to this account, when they learned at 4 p.m. that Chamberlain was flying to Berchtesgaden. Churchill, The Gathering Storm, page 312. But Halder's memory, and hence Churchill's account, is certainly an error. Hitler's daily schedule book, now in the Library of Congress, has several entries showing that he spent the 13th and 14th in Munich, where, among other things, he conferred with Ribbentrop at Bormann's home and visited the Sonnenwinkel, a cabaret, departing for the Obersalzberg at the end of the day of the 14th. There were double grounds for the feeling of utter frustration among the plotters. Their plans could be carried out only if Hitler were in Berlin, and they had been confident that since the Nuremberg rally had only sharpened the Czech crisis, he would certainly return immediately to the capital. In the second place, although some of the members of the conspiracy complacently assumed, as did the people of Britain, that Chamberlain was flying to Berchtesgaden to warn Hitler not to make the mistake that Wilhelm II had made in 1914 as to what Great Britain would do in the case of German aggression, Kort knew better. He had seen the text of Chamberlain's urgent message explaining to Hitler that he wanted to see him with a view to trying to find a peaceful solution. Furthermore, he had seen the telegram from his brother, Theodor Kort, counselor of the German embassy in London, that day, confiding that the Prime Minister was prepared to go a long way to meet Hitler's demands in the Sudetenland. "The effect on our plans," says Kort, "was bound to be disastrous. It would have been absurd to stage a putsch to overthrow Hitler at a moment when the British Prime Minister was coming to Germany to discuss with Hitler the peace of the world." However, on the evening of September 15th, according to Erich Kort, Dr. Paul Schmidt, who was in on the conspiracy and who, as we have seen, acted as sole interpreter and sole witness at the Hitler-Chamberlain talk, informed him by prearranged code that the Führer was still determined to conquer the whole of Czechoslovakia and that he had put forward to Chamberlain impossible demands in the hope that they would be refused. This intelligence revived the spirits of the conspirators. Kort informed Colonel Oster of it the same evening, and it was decided to go ahead with the plans as soon as Hitler returned to Berlin. "But first of all," Oster said, "we must get the bird back into his cage in Berlin." The bird flew back to his cage from the Godesberg talks on the afternoon of September 24th. On the morning of Black Wednesday, the 28th, Hitler had been in Berlin for nearly 4 days. On the 26th, he apparently had burned his bridges in his outburst at the Sportpalast. On the 27th, he had sent Sir Horace Wilson back to London empty-handed, and the British government's reaction had been to mobilize the fleet and warn Prague to expect an immediate German attack. During the day, he had also, as we have seen, ordered the assault units to take their combat positions on the Czech frontier and be ready for action on September 30th, 3 days hence. What were the conspirators waiting for? All the conditions they themselves had set had now been fulfilled. Hitler was in Berlin. He was determined to go to war. He had set the date for the attack on Czechoslovakia as September 30th, 2 days away now. Either the putsch must be made at once, or it would be too late to overthrow the dictator and stop the war. Kort declares that during the day of September 27th, the plotters set a definite date for action, September 29th. Gisevius, in his testimony on the stand at Nuremberg and also in his book, claims that the generals, Halder and Witzleben, decided to act immediately on September 28th after they got a copy of Hitler's defiant letter with its insulting demand to Chamberlain of the night before. "Oster received a copy of this defiant letter," Gisevius says, "late that night, September 27th, and on the morning of September 28th I took the copy to Witzleben. Witzleben went to Halder with it. Now, at last, the chief of the general staff had his desired, unequivocal proof that Hitler was not bluffing, that he wanted war. Tears of indignation ran down Halder's cheeks. Witzleben insisted that now it was time to take action. He persuaded Halder to go see Braukitsch. After a while, Halder returned to say that he had good news. Braukitsch was also outraged and would probably take part in the putsch. But either the text of the letter had been altered in the copying, or the generals misunderstood it. For, as we have seen, it was so moderate in tone, so full of promises to negotiate details with the Czechs and to give a formal guarantee for the remainder of Czechoslovakia, so conciliatory and suggesting to Chamberlain that he might continue his efforts, that the Prime Minister, after reading it, had immediately telegraphed Hitler suggesting a big power conference to settle the details, and at the same time wired Mussolini asking his support for such a proposal. Of this 11th-hour effort at appeasement, the generals apparently had no knowledge, but General von Braukitsch, the commander-in-chief of the army, may have had some inkling. According to Gisevius, Witzleben telephoned Braukitsch from Halder's office, told him that all was ready, and pleaded with him to lead the revolt himself. But the army commander was noncommittal. He informed Halder and Witzleben that he would first have to go over to the Führer's chancellery to see for himself whether the generals had assessed the situation correctly. Gisevius says that Witzleben rushed back to his military headquarters. "Gisevius," he declared excitedly, "the time has come." At 11 o'clock that morning of September 28th, the phone rang at Court's desk in the Foreign Office. Ciano was on the line from Rome and wanted urgently to speak to the German foreign minister. Ribbentrop was not available, he was at the Reich Chancellery, so the Italian foreign minister asked to be put through to his ambassador, Bernardo Attolico. The Germans listened in and recorded the call. It developed that Mussolini, and not his son-in-law, wanted to do the talking. Mussolini: "This is the Duce speaking, can you hear me?" Attolico: "Yes, I hear you." Mussolini: "Ask immediately for an interview with the Chancellor. Tell him the British government asked me through Lord Perth," the British ambassador in Rome, "to mediate in the Sudeten question. The point of difference is very small. Tell the Chancellor that I and Fascist Italy stand behind him. He must decide, but tell him I favor accepting the suggestion. You hear me?" Attolico: "Yes, I hear you." Mussolini: "Hurry." Out of breath, his face flushed with excitement, as Dr. Schmidt, the interpreter, noted, Ambassador Attolico arrived at the Chancellery to find that the French ambassador was already closeted with Hitler. Monsieur François Poncet had had a hard time getting there. Very late the night before, Bonnet, the French foreign minister, who was now intent on going Chamberlain one better, had telephoned his ambassador in Berlin and instructed him to see Hitler at the earliest possible moment and present a French proposal for surrendering the Sudetenland, which went much further than the British plan. Whereas the Prime Minister's proposal, delivered to Hitler at 11 p.m. on September 27th, offered Hitler the occupation of Zone 1 of the Sudetenland by October 1st, a mere token occupation of a tiny enclave, the French now proposed to hand over three large zones, which comprised most of the disputed territory, by October 1st. It was a tempting offer, but the French ambassador had great difficulty in making it. He phoned at 8 a.m. on September 28th for an appointment with the Chancellor, and when no response had been received by 10 o'clock, rushed his military attaché off to the Army General Staff to inform the German generals of the offer, which he was as yet unable to deliver. He enlisted the aid of the British ambassador. Sir Neville Henderson, who was only too ready to oblige anyone who might help prevent a war at any cost, telephoned Goering, and the field marshal said he would try to make the appointment. As a matter of fact, Henderson was trying to make one for himself, for he had been instructed to present to Hitler a final personal message from the Prime Minister, the one which Chamberlain had drafted late the night before, assuring Hitler that he could get everything he wanted without war and without delay, and proposing a conference of the powers to work out the details. Hitler received François Poncet at 11:15 a.m. The ambassador found him nervous and tense. Brandishing a map which he had hastily drawn up and which showed the large chunks of Czech territory which Czechoslovakia's principal ally was now prepared to hand over to Hitler on a platter, the French ambassador urged the Führer to accept the French proposals and spare Europe from war. Despite Ribbentrop's negative comments, which François Poncet says he dealt roundly with, Hitler was impressed, especially, as Dr. Schmidt noted, by the ambassador's map with its generous markings. At 11:40, the interview was suddenly interrupted by a messenger who announced that Attolico had just arrived with an urgent message for the Führer from Mussolini. Hitler left the room with Schmidt to greet the panting Italian ambassador. "I have an urgent message to you from the Duce," Attolico, who had a naturally hoarse voice, shouted from some distance off. After delivering it, he added that Mussolini begged the Führer to refrain from mobilization. "It was at this moment," says Schmidt, the only surviving eyewitness of the scene, "that the decision for peace was made. It was now just noon, 2 hours before the time limit on Hitler's ultimatum to the Czechs ran out." "Tell the Duce," Hitler said with obvious relief to Attolico, "that I accept his proposal." The rest of the day was anticlimactic. Ambassador Henderson followed Attolico and François Poncet to the Führer's presence. "At the request of my great friend and ally Mussolini," Hitler told Henderson, "I have postponed mobilizing my troops for 24 hours. As we have seen, Hitler already had mobilized all the troops available. He would give his decision on other matters, such as the proposed conference of the powers, after he had again consulted Mussolini. There followed much telephoning between Berlin and Rome. Schmidt says the two fascist dictators talked directly once. A few minutes before 2 p.m. on September 28th, just as his ultimatum was to expire, Hitler made up his mind, and invitations were hastily issued to the heads of government of Great Britain, France, and Italy to meet the Führer at Munich at noon on the following day to settle the Czech question. No invitation was sent to Prague or Moscow. Russia, the co-guarantor of Czechoslovakia's integrity in case of a German attack, was not to be allowed to interfere. The Czechs were not even asked to be present at their own death sentence. In his memoirs, Sir Neville Henderson gave most of the credit for saving the peace at this moment to Mussolini, and in this, he has been backed by most of the historians who have written of this chapter in European history. Alan Bullock, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, page 428, says, "Almost certainly it was Mussolini's intervention which turned the scale." But surely this is being overgenerous. Italy was the weakest of the big powers in Europe, and her military strength was so negligible that the German generals, as their papers make clear, treated it as a joke. Great Britain and France were the only powers that counted in German calculations. And it was the British Prime Minister who, from the start, had sought to convince Hitler that he could get the Sudetenland without a war. Chamberlain, not Mussolini, made Munich possible and thus preserved the peace for exactly 11 months. The cost of such a feat to his own country and to its allies and friends will be considered later, but it was, by any accounting as it turned out, almost beyond bearing. At 3:05 on Black Wednesday, which now appeared less dark than it had in the bleak morning hours, the British Prime Minister had begun to address the House of Commons in London, giving a detailed account of the Czech crisis and of the part which he and his government had played in trying to solve it. The situation he depicted was still uncertain, but it had improved. Mussolini, he said, had succeeded in getting Hitler to postpone mobilization for 24 hours. It was now 4:15, and Chamberlain had been speaking for 1 hour and 20 minutes and was nearing the end of his speech. At this point, he was interrupted. Sir John Simon, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, passed him a paper which had been handed down to the Treasury front bench by Lord Halifax, who had been sitting in the Peers' Gallery. "Whatever view honorable members may have had about Signor Mussolini," Chamberlain was saying, "I believe that everyone will welcome his gesture for peace." The Prime Minister paused, glanced at the paper, and smiled. "That is not all. I have something further to say to the House yet. I have now been informed by Herr Hitler that he invites me to meet him at Munich tomorrow morning. He has also invited Signor Mussolini and Monsieur Daladier. Signor Mussolini has accepted, and I have no doubt Monsieur Daladier will accept. I need not say what my answer will be." There was no need. The ancient chamber, the mother of parliaments, reacted with a mass hysteria without precedent in its long history. There was wild shouting and a wild throwing of order papers into the air, and many were in tears. And one voice was heard above the tumult which seemed to express the deep sentiments of all. Thank God for the Prime Minister! Jan Masaryk, the Czech minister, the son of the founding father of the Czechoslovak Republic, looked on from the diplomatic gallery, unable to believe his eyes. Later, he called on the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary in Downing Street to find out whether his country, which would have to make all the sacrifices, would be invited to Munich. Chamberlain and Halifax answered that it would not, that Hitler would not stand for it. Masaryk gazed at the two God-fearing Englishmen and struggled to keep control of himself. "If you have sacrificed my nation to preserve the peace of the world," he finally said, "I will be the first to applaud you. But if not, gentlemen, God help your souls." And what of the conspirators, the generals and the civilians, General Halder and General von Witzleben, Schacht and Gasevius and Kort, and the rest, who shortly before noon on that fateful day had believed, as Witzleben said, that their time had come? The answer can be given briefly in their own words, spoken much later when all was over, and they were anxious to prove to the world how opposed they had been to Hitler and his catastrophic follies, which had brought Germany to utter ruin after a long and murderous war. Neville Chamberlain, they all claimed, was the villain. By agreeing to come to Munich, he had forced them at the very last minute to call off their plans to overthrow Hitler and the Nazi regime. On February 25, 1946, as the long Nuremberg trial neared its end, General Halder was interrogated privately by Captain Sam Harris, a young New York attorney on the staff of the American prosecution. "It had been planned," Halder said, "to occupy by military force the Reich Chancellery and those government offices, particularly ministries, which were administered by party members and close supporters of Hitler, with the express intention of avoiding bloodshed, and then trying the group before the whole German nation. On the day, September 28th, Witzleben came to see me in my office during the noon hour. We discussed the matter. He requested that I give him the order of execution. We discussed other details, how much time he needed, etc. During this discussion, the news came that the British Prime Minister and the French Premier had agreed to come to Hitler for further talks. This happened in the presence of Witzleben. I therefore took back the order of execution because, owing to this fact, the entire basis for the action had been taken away. We were firmly convinced that we would be successful, but now came Mr. Chamberlain, and with one stroke the danger of war was averted. The critical hour for force was avoided. One could only wait in case a new chance should come." "Do I understand you to say that if Chamberlain had not come to Munich, your plan would have been executed and Hitler would have been deposed?" asked Captain Harris. "I can only say the plan would have been executed," General Halder replied. "I do not know if it would have been successful." Dr. Schacht, who at Nuremberg and in his post-war books clearly exaggerated the importance of his role in the various conspiracies against Hitler, also blamed Chamberlain for the failure of the Germans to carry out the plot on September 28th. "It is quite clear from the later course of history that this first attempt at a coup d'état by Witzleben and myself was the only one which could have brought a real turning point in Germany's fate. It was the only attempt which was planned and prepared in good time. In the autumn of 1938 it was still possible to count on bringing Hitler to trial before the Supreme Court, but all subsequent efforts to get rid of him necessarily involved attempts on his life. I had made preparations for a coup d'état in good time, and I had brought them to within an ace of success. History had decided against me. The intervention of foreign statesmen was something I could not possibly have taken into account." And Gasevius, who was Schacht's stoutest champion on the witness stand at Nuremberg, added, "The impossible had happened. Chamberlain and Daladier were flying to Munich. Our revolt was done for. For a few hours I went on imagining that we could revolt anyway. But Witzleben soon demonstrated to me that the troops would never revolt against the victorious Führer. Chamberlain saved Hitler." Did he? Or was this merely an excuse of the German civilians and generals for their failure to act? In his interrogation at Nuremberg, Halder explained to Captain Harris that there were three conditions for a successful revolutionary action. The first condition is a clear and resolute leadership. The second condition is the readiness of the masses of the people to follow the idea of the revolution. The third condition is the right choice of time. According to our views, the first condition of a clear, resolute leadership was there. The second condition we thought fulfilled, too, because the German people did not want war. Therefore, the nation was ready to consent to a revolutionary act for fear of war. The third condition, the right choice of time, was good because we had to expect within 48 hours the order for carrying out a military action. Therefore, we were firmly convinced that we would be successful. But now came Mr. Chamberlain, and with one stroke the danger of war was avoided. One can doubt that General Halder's first condition was ever fulfilled, as he claimed. For had there been clear and resolute leadership, why should the generals have hesitated for 4 days? They had on tap the military force to easily sweep Hitler and his regime aside. Witzleben had a whole army corps, the 3rd, in and around Berlin. Brockdorf Ahlefeld had a crack infantry division in nearby Potsdam. Höfner had a panzer division to the south, and the 2 ranking police officers in the capital, Count von Helldorf and Count von der Schulenburg, had a large force of well-armed police to help out. All of these officers, according to the plotters themselves, were but waiting for the word from Halder to spring into action with overwhelming armed force. And the population of Berlin, scared to death that Hitler was about to bring on a war, would have, so far as this writer could at first hand judge them, spontaneously backed the coup. Whether Halder and Witzleben would have finally acted had Chamberlain not agreed to come to Munich is a question that can never be answered with any degree of finality. Given the peculiar attitude of these generals at this time, which made them concerned with overthrowing Hitler not in order to bring an end to the tyranny and terror of his regime, but merely to avert a lost war, it is possible that they might have acted had not the Munich conference been arranged. The information necessary to establish how well the plot was hatched, how ready the armed forces were to march, and how near Halder and Witzleben really came to giving the order to act has so far been lacking. We have only the statements of a handful of participants who, after the war, were anxious to prove their opposition to National Socialism, and what they have said and written in self-defense is often conflicting and confusing. For example, the explanation for the failure of the revolt given by General Georg Thomas, the brilliant chief of the Economic and Armaments branch of OKW and one of the conspirators. The execution of this enterprise was unfortunately frustrated because, according to the view of the commanding general appointed for the task, Witzleben, the younger officers were found to be unreliable for a political action of this kind. See his paper, Gedanken und Ereignisse, published in the December 1945 number of the Schweizerische Monatshefte. If, as the conspirators claim, their plans were on the point of being carried out, the announcement of Chamberlain's trip to Munich certainly cut the ground from underneath their feet. The generals could scarcely have arrested Hitler and tried him as a war criminal when it was obvious that he was about to achieve an important conquest without war. What is certain among all these uncertainties, and here Dr. Schacht must be conceded his point, is that such a golden opportunity never again presented itself to the German opposition to dispose of Hitler, bring a swift end to the Third Reich, and save Germany and the world from war. The Germans, if one may risk a generalization, have a weakness for blaming foreigners for their failures. The responsibility of Chamberlain and Halifax, of Daladier and Bonnet for Munich, and thus for all the disastrous consequences which ensued, is overwhelming. But they may be pardoned, to some extent, for not taking very seriously the warnings of a revolt of a group of German generals and civilians, most of whom had served Hitler with great ability up to this moment. They, or at least some of their advisers in London and Paris, may have recalled the bleak facts of recent German history, that the army had helped put the former Austrian corporal into power, had been delighted at the opportunities he gave it to rearm, had apparently not objected to the destruction of individual freedom under National Socialism, or done anything about the murder of its own General von Schleicher or the removal on a dastardly frame-up of its commanding officer, General von Fritsch, and, recently, had gone along with the rape of Austria, indeed had supplied the military force to carry it out. Whatever blame may be heaped on the Archipesers in London and Paris, and great it undoubtedly is, the fact remains that the German generals themselves and their civilian co-conspirators failed at an opportune moment to act on their own.